Open your Bible, if you will, to Deuteronomy chapters 28 through 30. 28 through 30. You'll recognize these as the... Come on in. We're studying this evening history and geography of the Bible from Deuteronomy chapter 28 through 30 to introduce our thought this evening. And we noted in our last study that in Deuteronomy chapter 28, Moses continued to warn the children of Israel regarding what would happen to them if they did not keep the commandments, statutes, and ordinances that God had commanded them. Now, again, the period of time that we're talking about is during the time of wandering, as we sometimes think of that, in the wilderness as a result of their refusal to go in and take the land that God had promised to give them. And we studied about that, and we'll talk a little bit more about it tonight from Deuteronomy chapter 13 and 14. But in this setting of the book of Deuteronomy, Moses has made numerous, what some have called, speeches to the children of Israel and reminding them of the great things that God has done. And in Deuteronomy chapter 4, we saw that in our study Sunday morning, verses 24 and 25, where he told them that when you come into the land and begin to worship other gods, what's going to happen to you? You'll lose the land. That's right. He told them again in Deuteronomy chapter 8, the same thing. Here again in Deuteronomy chapter 28 through 30, in what we call the blessings and the curses, he tells them the same thing. And in Deuteronomy chapter 30, we noted in verses 1 through 10, this is where we concluded our study Sunday morning, this when and then construction occurs yet again. In verse 1, he says, "And it shall come to pass when all these things are come upon thee, the blessing and the curse which I have set before thee, that and thou shalt call them to mind among all the nations, whether Jehovah thy God hath driven thee, and shalt return unto Jehovah thy God, and shalt obey his voice according to all that I command thee this day, thou and thy children with all thy heart and with all thy soul, that then Jehovah thy God will turn thy captivity and have compassion upon thee, and will return and gather thee from all the peoples, whether Jehovah thy God hath scattered thee." Now, I want you to be well familiar with verses 1 through 10, especially verse 10, because in this setting we note that the condition is when you turn and keep the commandments and statutes written in this book of the law. What was that that they were to keep? The law of Moses. The law of Moses. Now, the reason that's so important to us in our thinking is, as we discuss the subject of premillennialism with our friends and neighbors, sometimes restoration passages are cited to affirm that at the second coming of Christ, there's going to be a mass transportation of Jews to the land of Palestine, and the promise that God made unto Abraham relative to the land is at that time going to be fulfilled. Of course, that says it hasn't yet been fulfilled. But I want you to notice what Moses says in this passage would be necessary for a restoration. And indeed, this is a restoration passage. But when you look at a restoration passage, what does that already presume? There was something to restore. That's right. There was something to restore. And so Moses in this text is talking about a turning or a restoration. But that restoration would occur as they would keep the commandments, statutes, and ordinances written in this book of the law. Now we noted as we concluded four things necessary in order for that restoration to occur by these conditions. Randy? Deuteronomy chapter 30, 1 through 10. Specifically in verse 10. When Moses says in verse 10, "If thou shalt obey the voice of Jehovah thy God and keep his commandments and his statutes, which are written in this book of the law, if thou turn unto Jehovah thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul," there's the condition upon which restoration would be granted. We've got to look at the condition, though. Keeping the law. Terry? It cannot. Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Randy, you said you were playing catch up just a little bit. Let me get a chart up that I used last time, if I can find it. There it is. And we will cite that once more very quickly. Restoration promises, Isaiah 10, Jeremiah 30, Jeremiah 27. We saw in our previous study, of course, all that fulfilled during the restoration contemporary with Ezra and Nehemiah. But in order for this condition to be met, Terry, here I think is the point you're making. It's just not possible to reinstate the law. What does the New Testament say about that? Those of you in our authority class, we've talked about that extensively. Are we ever going to be under the law? Anybody ever going to be under the law? That's what Paul said, Galatians chapter 2, verse 21. That's exactly right. Now, the New Testament says that's never going to be happening. Never, ever. It was nailed to the cross. But now, if there's going to be a restoration according to that condition, you've got to reinstate the priesthood, which was done during the days of Nehemiah. And in order to reinstate the priesthood, what do you have to reinstate? The genealogies. Was done during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. What's the New Testament say about the genealogies? All right. They lead to questioning and strife. Never shall it happen. And if you're going to restore the law, you have to restore Old Testament worship with the animal sacrifices and all of that, and that gets to the heart of your point, that Christ died for nothing.
Just a question about the genealogy. After Jerusalem was destroyed and the temple was destroyed, there was no way they could do that.
That's exactly right, because the genealogies, the books of the genealogies were destroyed, and during the days of Ezra and Nehemiah, they got the books of the genealogies out and read them and studied them so that the restoration could be according to the tribes. They had to restore the priesthood. They had to know who was a Levite and all of that sort of thing. But you see, the New Testament says never is this going to happen. And this is just a little side note on our history and geography study. But the point is, as a condition of God's blessings being upon the people of Israel relative to the land, it was conditioned upon keeping the law. Now Moses is telling them that before they come in and take the land. That's so important to our study and so important to our understanding at this point. Any questions or comments just here? All right, everybody got all that? We're good? Okay. Well, we know from the text that after chapter 30 of the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 31 says, "And Moses went and spake these words unto all Israel, and he said unto them, I am 120 years old this day. I can no more go out and come in. And Jehovah has said unto me, Thou shalt not go over this Jordan." Why not? What'd Moses do? All right. He had not given God proper credit when he brought forth water from the rock. He had struck the rock, or smitten the rock, instead of speaking to the rock, as God had said. And we can read that in Numbers chapter 20, beginning in verse 2. So Moses is saying, I am about to die. But in verse 6, he said, be strong and of good courage. In verse 7, Moses called unto Joshua and said unto him, in the sight of all of Israel, be strong and of good courage. For thou shalt go with this people into the land, which Jehovah hath sworn unto their fathers to give them, and thou shalt cause them to inherit it. In verse 8, he said, he will not fail thee, neither forsake thee. Fear not, neither be dismayed. That's chapter 31. Now, hold that thought as we get over to chapter 1 of the book of Joshua. But before we get to chapter 1 of the book of Joshua, Look at chapter 34, the last chapter of the book of Deuteronomy. Chapter 34. And we note in verse 1 that Moses went up from the plains of Moab up unto Mount Nebo to the top of Pisgah that is over against Jericho. And Jehovah showed him all the land of Gilead unto Dan and all Naphtali, and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh, and all the land of Judah unto the hinder sea, and the south, and the plain of the valley of Jericho, the city of palm trees unto Zoar. Now, you've got your map out, right? I'm looking for a particular map. I thought I had it here handy. No, I guess I don't. Well, you look at your map while I lay my finger on this. It's right here. The one I want you to see. When God shows Moses the land, here's Mount Nebo. To orient yourself, here's the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, the Dead Sea. Everybody know where we are? Okay. Here's Mount Nebo. And Moses is upon Mount Nebo elevation we described earlier, about 3,000 feet elevation. And the text tells us that God shows him the land of Gilead. Where's that? See it here? Here's Moses. Here's Gilead. He shows him the land of Naphtali and the land of Ephraim and Manasseh. Here we've got Ephraim and Manasseh up in this area. And then the text tells us in verse 2, and all the land of Judah, which we know was down in this area. There's Jerusalem. Jerusalem was in Judah. And it also tells us unto the hinder sea. Where's that? The Mediterranean Sea. And then it tells us, and the plain of the valley of Jericho. Here's Jericho, the valley of Jericho, right along, within about 15 miles thereabouts of the Dead Sea. And then it tells us the city of palm trees unto Zoar. Zoar, you remember, is right down here at the southern tip of the Dead Sea. And here's Moses up here. Looking across over here would be something in the neighborhood of what, about 75, 80 miles? From Mount Nebo, 3,000 feet to sea level to see the Mediterranean. Looking up to the north up here, we've got Mount Hermon, about 10,000 feet elevation, just north of Ephraim, or the land that Ephraim was to receive. Mount Hermon, do you think you could see Mount Hermon 10,000 feet up here from a mountain of 3,000 feet down here that's about, just guessing, maybe 75, 80 miles away? Oh, sure. And from Mount Nebo, looking down here, probably what, about 40, 50 miles, something like it? Think you could see that far on a clear day? The point I'm trying to get you to see is that when God took him up here and showed him the land, look at verse 4. It says, and Jehovah said unto him, this is the land which I swear unto Abraham, unto Isaac, and unto Jacob, saying, I will give it unto thy seed. I have caused thee to see it with thine eyes, but thou shalt not go over thither. What is it that Moses sees here from Mount Nebo? He can look to the north. Here's Mount Hermon. He can see everything in between. He can look to the south. He can see down here to Zoar, down at the southern end of the Dead Sea. He can see the Mediterranean Sea over here. Can Moses actually see all the land that God promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? That's what the text tells us. From the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates, Moses gets to see it. Now, the reason why that's so important is labeling this on a timeline. When you get this on a timeline, there are those who say, well, you know, that really didn't happen exactly that way. So all of the land promise has not yet been fulfilled. Thus, it's going to be fulfilled down at the second coming of Christ somewhere. Well, we want to get our ducks in a row. Turn, if you will, to Acts chapter 7. Acts chapter 7. Remember, if you would please, that Stephen in Acts chapter 7 is giving a very brief highlighted history of the people of God from the time of Abraham. And I want you just to kind of pick up the reading. Oh, there at verse 11 would be a good place to start, I suppose. It says, "Now there came a famine over all Egypt and Canaan, and great affliction, and our fathers found no sustenance. But when Jacob heard that there was grain in Egypt, he sent forth our fathers the first time. And at the second time, Joseph was made known to his brethren, and Joseph's race became manifest unto Pharaoh. And Joseph sent and called to him Jacob, his father, and all his kindred, 70 souls. And Jacob went down into Egypt, and he died, himself and our fathers, and they were carried over unto Shechem, and laid in the tomb that Abraham bought for a price of silver of the sons of Hamor in Shechem. But as the time of the promise drew nigh, which God vouchsafed unto Abraham, the people grew and multiplied in Egypt, till there arose another king over Egypt who knew not Joseph. The same dealt craftily with our race and ill-treated our fathers, that they should cast out their babes to the end that they might not live. At which season Moses was born and was exceeding fair, and he was nourished 3 months in his father's house. And when he was cast out, Pharaoh's daughter took him up and nourished him for her own son. And Moses was instructed in all the wisdom of the Egyptians." Drop down to verse 23 real quick. It says, "But when he was well nigh 40 years old, it came into his heart to visit his brethren, the children of Israel." Drop down a little further, if you will. In verse 30, we're really passing time. It says, "And when 40 years were fulfilled, an angel appeared unto him at the wilderness of Mount Sinai in a flame of fire in a bush. And when Moses saw it, he wondered at the sight, and he drew near to behold. There came a voice from the Lord," or of the Lord. Drop down now to verse 36. "This man led them forth, having wrought wonders and signs in Egypt, and in the Red Sea, and in the wilderness 40 years. This is that Moses, who said unto the children of Israel, a prophet shall God raise up unto you from among your brethren like unto me." In verse 40, they instruct Aaron to make us gods that shall go before us. In verse 41, he brings it before them, the golden calf. And then, if you'll drop down to verse 44, I guess. It says, "Our fathers had the tabernacle of the testimony in the wilderness, even as he appointed, who spake unto Moses that he should make it according to the figure that he had seen, which also our fathers in their turn brought in with Joshua when they entered on the possession of the nations that God thrust out before the face of our fathers unto the days of David." That's where I wanted us to be. You see what just happened there in those two verses? What just happened in verses 44 and 45? In verse 44, the tabernacle is built. You see that? And then in verse 45, it says, "Which also our fathers in their turn brought in with Joshua when they entered on the possession of the nations that God thrust out." What just happened in verse 45? They got the land. Yeah, Joshua brought them into the land. You see, the sequence of these events is real important. Stephen doesn't just skip over that and say, no, that didn't happen. But that's going to happen down at the second coming of Christ, and then move on with his storyline. You see, there is a sequence of events that Stephen recognizes as history. And when we go back to Deuteronomy chapter 34, and Moses sees this land, and he tells Joshua, "You're going to be the one to lead the people into the land." And then he dies there on Mount Nebo, and God buries him. And then in chapter 1 of the book of Joshua, the instructions are of God to Joshua, "You're going to lead them in." Now it makes you wonder, just what land was it that Moses saw? What land was it that Moses commissions Joshua to lead these people into? And then in Joshua chapter 1, what land is it that Joshua is about to lead them into? You see, the sequence of events on both sides, both sides. It's bookcase just so we can know that that's what Joshua did. That was his purpose, to lead them into the land and conquer the land. What land? The land that he had promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's not something to occur at the second coming of Christ. Terry? Okay. So while you have your Bible open there to Deuteronomy chapter 34, verse 5 tells us, so Moses, the servant of Jehovah, died there in the land of Moab according to the word of Jehovah. And he buried him in the valley in the land of Moab over against Beth Peor, but no man knoweth of his sepulcher unto this day. And Moses was 120 years old when he died, and his eye was not dimmed, nor his natural force abated. So this is the land that was promised to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Moses sees it, but he doesn't get to go into it. Any questions or comments just here? Okay. Well, I have several I want to talk with you about as soon as I get on the right chart here. Right there. Yes, Randy? I believe it is. Yeah. Yeah. We've got Elijah that was taken up in a fiery chariot. We've got Enoch that was and was not, but God buried this man. No one knows where. Yeah. Interesting observation. Yeah. Anything else? Well, there are a lot of questions that you should have answered in your lesson sheet review over lessons 13 and 14, and I really want to talk about Joshua, but I guess that would be the next logical thing for us to talk about those review questions. Being as everyone has those all ready to go, we can do that rather quickly, and then we can talk about the book of Joshua. Right? I said we can do these questions quickly because everybody has them already answered, and then we can go to the book of Joshua, right? Okay. Pardon me? Oh, well, that's the next natural thing. You know, after you finish lesson 14 in the book of Deuteronomy, you've got to do the questions before you go to Joshua. That's the next lesson. All right. Well, let's look at this chart just carefully because it helps us to see what we're doing. But the questions, number one on your page number 63, why did the Israelites go to Egypt to live? Why did they go to Egypt, Carolyn? All right, famine. This famine's become widespread in the land of Canaan and the land of Egypt and surrounding areas, and there's grain in Egypt. Why?
Because earlier God caused Joseph to end up there, so that's who he's convinced, and he rose from the pit to the pinnacle.
The pit to the pinnacle. That's good. Well put. Very good. So that was the only place that there was food. And so Joseph tells his brothers after the second visit down into Egypt that all these events, the ugly things you did to me, you intended that for evil, but God intended it for good, to preserve us, all of us here alive this day. And so I'm not here because of what you did, but because of what God did, he tells them. All right, very good. Another note that I want us to remember in connection with that question is when God was speaking to Jacob, God had told Jacob that I will make of you a great nation where? in Egypt. Look, if you will, at verse 46. I'm sorry, chapter 46 of the book of Genesis. Chapter 46, beginning in verse 1. Of course, the latter few verses of chapter 45 is where Joseph has sent wagons and goods and so forth to bring his family from Canaan down into the land of Egypt. And in verse 1 of chapter 46, it says, "And Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices unto the God of his father Isaac. And God spake unto Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here am I. And he said, I am God, the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. And I will go down with thee into Egypt, and I will also surely bring thee up again, and Joseph shall put his hand upon thine eyes." God assures Jacob it's okay to go, because it's there that the promise that I made to Abraham, I'll make of you a great nation, that's where that's going to transpire. You'll become a great nation down in the land of Egypt. So we want to note these verses in Genesis chapter 46, verses 3 and 4. And of course, this is reminiscent of the text of Genesis 12, you remember, verses 1, 2, and 3, where that threefold promise was made, the land, nation, and seed promise was made unto Abraham and then unto Isaac. In what chapter? Genesis chapter 26, and then to Jacob in 28. Very good, very good. All right. Question number two. Why could they not leave anytime they chose? Joey? They were enslaved. That's right. They were growing so rapidly, Pharaoh became concerned that if they had an enemy, the Israelites might side with the enemy and it would all be over for the Egyptians. Right. Yeah, that's a good observation. We need to remember that, because the term Pharaoh is like calling a man king. It's a title. It's not necessarily his name. And how many pharaohs were there? I've forgotten. He didn't know Joseph.
I thought it was interesting when I reread that too, that it was Joseph died and then all of that generation. So even the hierarchy in Egypt, they were all gone too.
So it indicates the passing of some years, doesn't it? Okay. Yes. So they were under Egyptian bondage. Their lives were made bitter with hard labor, hard work. They became slaves, Joey, as you pointed out, from Exodus chapter 1, verses 8 through 14. Number 3 in your list of questions, name the 10 plagues that brought about their release. Richard?
Water
to blood. What else? Froggies. Then the lice and the flies. All right. Now, we've talked about all of these rather extensively and how that they all proved authority over many Egyptian gods. Well, the firstborn male of the kings was to be recognized as blessed by the gods. So I'm going to assume that it would be the firstborn of the male children. I'm not certain. Let's go back and see if we can find that. Where did it? Yeah. Might have been just the firstborn. I don't know. We'll have to look at the gender of the word and see if it's implied. Yeah, that was the thing of the importance of the firstborn among the Egyptian pharaohs. This was a blessing to Egypt. Yes, Jenny?
I'm not sure that you can necessarily assume that it was always the firstborn male that died, because it does say specifically that somebody died in every house in Egypt. So if it was just males, there should be at least one family in Egypt that didn't have it.
Well, that's possible. Just girls, yeah. Yeah. Before I would answer that, though, Lynn, there's reason for speculation. But before I would, I think, want to speculate on it, I'd want to go back and study the text and see if the word indicates male or female gender.
Of course, a lot of men will have more than one wife in order to get that son, or divorce one and marry another to get that son. So maybe it was his son.
Well, you know, interestingly enough, hang on just a second. In the 13th chapter of Exodus, the 13th chapter, we have the consecration of the firstborn. And in that, these sons would ask, or verse 14, when thy son asketh thee in time to come, what is this? That thou shalt say unto him, by strength of hand, Jehovah brought us out from Egypt, from the house of bondage. And it came to pass, when Pharaoh would hardly let us go, that Jehovah slew all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, both the firstborn of man and the firstborn of beast. Therefore I sacrifice unto Jehovah all that openeth the womb, being males. Verse 15 of Exodus 13. But all the firstborn of my sons I redeem, and it shall be for a sign upon thy hand, and for frontlets between thine eyes. For by strength of hand Jehovah brought us forth out of Egypt. I want to read more before I would affirm that that included firstborn females. I think that tilts the scale a little bit to think firstborn among the males. But I want to go back and read some more on that, Lynn, before I become dogmatic. Yeah, I'd want to go back and review that a little bit. But from the text there of chapter 13, makes me think that the redemption was of the males. Has to be a reason for that. We'll think about that some more. Okay? But it caused them to come forth out of the land of Egypt. Note, chapter number 4, it is only about 200 miles from Egypt to Canaan. Why did it take the Israelites 40 years to make the journey? Richard? Well, yeah, I suppose. But I'm not real sure that that was the problem. What was the problem?
They were penalized because they refused to go in and take the land like God told them.
All right. God said go in and take it, and they did not do so. This process of Numbers 13 and 14 involved the sending in of spies, 12 of them, one for each tribe. 10 of them came back and reported, we can't do that. And two of them, whose names were Joshua and Caleb, said, yes, we can. And upon their insistence in Numbers chapter 14, what did their insistence almost get them? Stoned. That's right. Almost stoned. All right, so God wanted to teach them to rely upon Him during this time of what we refer to as wilderness wandering. They learned to be dependent upon God for their food. They learned to be dependent upon God for their water. And they wandered for 38 plus years. The Hebrew writer tells us because of unbelief. Now I want you to know where that is. Hebrews what? All right, chapter 3 and chapter 4. Because of unbelief. Very good, Bruce. Number 5, which promise to Abraham has been fulfilled by the end of this section of Bible history? What were the three promises, Joey? The nation promise. All right, very good. Genesis 12, 1 through 7. And as we come to the point just prior to the giving of the law, in Exodus chapter 19, if you're making a list of passages to remember, this should be on that list. Exodus chapter 19, verses 5 and 6. Now therefore, if ye will obey my voice indeed and keep my covenant, then ye shall be mine own possession from among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And ye shall be unto me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. God Himself calls them a holy nation just prior to the giving of the law. Of course, they agree that we're going to do that. Yes. Sure. Sure it is.
You know, we are a royal priesthood. You can cite all kinds of New Testament passages that would show that conceptually that promise that he made to them has a spiritual counterpart or analogy, if you will, with us today.
That's right. That's 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5 and verse 9. Yes. Verse 5 and verse 9. Very good. All right, number 6. What was the covenant between God and the Israelites? Now, this is just a continuation here of Exodus chapter 19. What was the covenant between God and the Israelites? Chris? Do you remember? Well, we'll have to look at that text. Yep, that's right, and they've agreed to do that. They said that we will do just what he has said. If you will obey me, I will be your God, and ye shall be my people. And Joey, to your point, here's the passage. We today are a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. Because of our obedience to the gospel, we become an elect people. Yes, Chris? Interesting observation. Yeah. Interesting observation. Number 7, how did the Israelites know where to camp and how long to stay there? Carolyn? All right. These two passages, this is how God separated the Israelites from the Egyptians, and he led them with the pillar of fire at night, the pillar of cloud by day. Turn that around. And that's where we find that. Where did the following events take place? Now, I'm going to be real loose on this because of the two maps that we've been looking at and dependent upon which crossing of the Red Sea, which location you believe to be the most consistent. Now, to answer the questions, this is one of the big problems with a lesson book. When you use a lesson book, you use the lesson book to the end that the writer of the lesson book asks the questions, okay? So if you ask the questions that he asks, you answer the questions like he intends for you to answer them, unless you want to take issue with it, and sometimes I do. So we're going to look at some of this, all right? Where did the following events take place? Now, the typical route, the traditional route, is the one that the writer of our lesson book takes. And, of course, here's the Mediterranean Sea and the land of Egypt, the River Nile. And here's the Red Sea, the Gulf of Suez, the Gulf of Aqaba, and you know where you are. Here's the Dead Sea, the Sea of Galilee, the Jordan River, and so forth. Now, question number one, as we look at the location of these places, God spoke directly to the people, where? Mount Sinai. Now, the thing is, when you put it on the map, the traditional location of Mount Sinai is here. But can any of you tell me how this particular place was located on the mount, on the map? All right, Constantine's mother, I believe, had a dream, and she said, God told me that this is where that is. All right, so there it is. And because it was labeled then Mount Sinai, this was then afterward called the Sinai Peninsula. Now, I don't know about your thinking, but my thinking was all turned around on that. I thought that this was the Sinai Peninsula. And so they're coming down through the Sinai Peninsula, and here's the big mountain where God gave the law. Therefore, that had to be Mount Sinai because it was the big mountain located in the Sinai Peninsula. No, the order's reversed. Constantine's mother said this is where Mount Sinai is. Therefore, this must be the Sinai Peninsula. Now, others have come along with a little bit different thinking on that and said that the crossing was not up here, the crossing was perhaps down here, or the crossing was perhaps over here, and that Mount Sinai is actually located over here in Arabia. And I would challenge you to think about what Paul said about that in Galatians chapter 4, there about verse 24 and 25. But this is the map that's in our book. Okay? So I want to make that very clear for us. Question number two. Joshua led the people through a river on dry ground. We don't have to speculate about that now. Where was that? The Jordan River. That's right. The Jordan River. Now, we don't know the exact place of that crossing, but it was known for some time after this because a pillar of stones was erected, and we're going to talk all about that when we get to Joshua chapter 3 and especially Joshua chapter 4, verse 20. All right, number 3. Pharaoh's army drowned, Exodus chapter 14. Where? In the Red Sea. All right. Now, depending on what position you hold about the crossing, whether it was on this portion, the Gulf of Suez, or whether it was the Gulf of Aqaba over here, Pharaoh's soldiers drowned in the Red Sea. As far as I know. Yeah. As far as I know. Well, yes. Miss Donna Anderson showed me some information, and I went online, researched it, and it's kind of interesting. Those who take the position that the crossing was in the Gulf of Aqaba, right up here. Not down here now at the Straits of Straits of Tiran, okay, up here, I forget the name of this location, but those who take the position that the crossing was up here in the Gulf of Aqaba, some have said that they have sent a submarine that you got, remote submarine, and they took pictures and so forth, and they've got pictures down on the bottom of that portion of the Red Sea of what appears to be chariot wheels and chariot axles that are covered with coral. And others discount the work of this man and the claims that he made, but be that as it may, that evidence exists in the minds of some. Yeah, that's right, yeah. Well, those arguments enter all into this picture. Some think that the crossing of the Red Sea, depending on where, if it was up in this area, the Red Sea has been known as the Reed Sea. And some say then, well, it was shallow, and so it was something they could have walked across, thus no miracle. The answer to that's very obvious. Then the miracle was in the drowning of Pharaoh's army in such shallow water. If it wasn't in the parting of the waters, it had to be that. So be that as it may. But this is the area, David, where some believe chariot wheels have been found, and some oppose that place of crossing either here or here because of the depth of the water. Some say that, Richard, I think you were commenting that some affirm that it's about 2 miles deep in certain portions here. So, but a miracle is a miracle. whether it would be the killing of the Egyptian army or the separation of waters down 2 miles deep. I don't have to explain the miracle, okay? Some have explained, I was talking with Richard, that the strong east wind was actually a very cold wind, and the walls of water were actually held back because they were frozen. Pardon me?
The wind off the Arabian Desert was so cold.
That must have been the miracle. Anyway, in there somewhere, yeah. The people built a golden calf to worship, Exodus 32. Where did they build it? The base of Mount Sinai, that's right. And again, that depends on whether it's here or over here. The base of Mount Sinai. Moses went into the mount for 40 days, again, Mount Sinai. And then Moses put a tree into the water to make it sweet. All right, Marah. And again, this is simply an encampment that is about 3,500 years old. And it would be difficult to locate an encampment where they spent perhaps a few days in such rugged country. It's possible, when you look at a Google Earth map, that they traveled down this way and crossed here. It's possible then that after the crossing, the water they were seeking was here instead of here. So there are some variables in that that you want to think about, I suppose. Yes, Terry? That's right. There wouldn't be artifacts from Israel unless they just lost something, left it behind. That's true. That's true. There wouldn't be really anything to find. But I don't want you to trouble your minds about being precise in the location of these encampments because you see the difficulty of identifying and being dogmatic in the location of an encampment that's 3,500 years old and was always thought to be here until, what, about the last 50 years? When other evidence began to arise, supposing then that Mount Sinai may not have been here, it may have been over here. So be that as it may. And, of course, the earth swallowed Korah, Dathan, and Abiram. We know where that was as far as the place is concerned, but the location of the place is somewhat iffy. What is the name of the place? Kadesh. Kadesh Barnea in the wilderness of Paran. And of course, if you look at Numbers chapter 15, I believe it is, the very last verse, it identifies the wilderness of Paran. And then as you continue on down into the text, that's identified as Kadesh or Kadesh Barnea. Now, the exact location we don't know, but it's generally in this area that they remained for the remaining 38 years. Now, if Sinai, let me throw this out just to think about, if Sinai is not here and is in fact here, then you see that their journey north to put them into the land would involve Kadesh Barnea and the wilderness of Paran being here. But if Sinai is here and they journeyed north and sent out spies, then of course Kadesh would not be over here, but it would be over here. Now the thing that's interesting about that is in either case, Kadesh would be on the edge of Edom. The text tells us that it was on the edge of Edom, but Edom is right here. So it would fit in either scenario. Pardon me? You like this scenario better? Oh, the one over here? I think so. Yeah, I think so. All right, we'll start with these and finish them next time. For next time, be sure you have, for Sunday morning, all these questions done, okay? Have that all done. And read the book of Joshua, okay? At least through chapter 11.